From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
At the height of the holiday season, is it safe to fly? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Obama administration now admits that air travel security failed on Christmas Day. It's beefing up measures at airports and in the air. At the same time, it's going all out to determine how a bomb was smuggled onto an airplane, where it took action by passengers to stop it from being ignited. Could existing technology have provided better security? Has it been held off by concerns about cost, privacy, and profiling? Also today, the growing problem of hunger in a struggling economy. We'll hear about poverty, unemployment, and the increasing dependence on food stamps. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Airline security is leading today's news, including this program. But the biggest problem for most Americans is still the economy. In our second half hour, we'll hear about the growing numbers, including children who can't get enough to eat. First, this news update. Yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano was quoted as saying air travel security's system worked to prevent a tragedy on Christmas Day. Today, she said her comment was taken out of context and that a lot did go wrong.
We need to go backwards and say, what happened here? What do we need to change? What do we need to do to make sure that passengers are safe moving forward?
Karen DeYoung is senior diplomatic correspondent at The Washington Post. She's covering this story for the paper. And Karen, thanks a lot for being on our program today.
You're very welcome.
What's being done today that was not done before this incident to try to reassure travelers?
Well, I haven't been watching very closely the sort of traveler thing, but the administration, I think, is coming out and trying to make statements as strong as it can to say that it's got this situation under control, that it's basically reviewing and investigating two aspects of it. One, why wasn't this man's name on a watch list that would have prevented him from getting on the flight, since he was known to the counterterrorism community here? And secondly, how did he, with all of the physical and technological screening methods at airports and certainly in the airport in Amsterdam, why was he able to actually carry an explosive substance onto the plane? How come no one caught that?
As to the first question, why wasn't he on the watch list? His father had turned him into the embassy in Nigeria, as I recall. And what happened after that?
Well, I think the embassy did the right thing. I mean, the father's report was pretty nonspecific. It just said, you know, I'm worried about my son. I don't know exactly where he is. I don't like the people he's been hanging around with. And the embassy did what it was supposed to do, which is to send this report into the National Counterterrorism Center here just outside of Washington, which maintains a massive database on all information like that. It can be as extreme as this intelligence intercept says that a plot is underway, or a worried father called the embassy and said he doesn't know where his son is. They then look through all this information every day, see if it matches anything that's already in the system, and if it rises above a certain threshold, they kick it over into a separate database that's maintained by the FBI, which is where agencies like the Transportation Security Agency, which issues no-fly lists, or the State Department, which grants visas, if they want to take this information and translate it into a watch listing of this individual. With the criteria that's in place right now, and has been in place actually since 2004, one report from a father on a person whose name has never shown up in any terrorism database before was not enough to kick it over into the next category of watching. And so I don't think it's a case, as far as I can tell so far, that someone didn't do what they were supposed to do. It's a question of whether the system actually is adequate to catch something like this. I mean, clearly it's not, and that will turn up in the review that the administration's doing now, and they will have to decide how they want to change the system. Now, it also needs to be said that Congress, which now is demanding some change in the system, actually several years ago demanded that the lists themselves be more restrictive because they were stopping too many people at the airport who had no terrorist connection, but their name was spelled in a certain way, they had a certain birth date, and there were lots of complaints about it at that time. So that's the trade-off that you have to make.
Now, the second issue you mentioned, how did he get the material on board? This is PETN, which is a known material used by terrorists in the past to try to kill people. It was the same thing that the shoe bomber had, Mr. Reed, on his shoes. How come it got on board?
Well, it's not something that would show up on a metal detector, which is what most airports have. A lot of airports, including Amsterdam, have these more sophisticated explosive detectors and kind of X-ray machines that it would have shown up on, but they don't use them on everybody. They use them on selected people. And the usage of these machines, again, has been a subject of a lot of complaints. Civil liberties organizations, members of parliament, members of governments think that they're too intrusive. Travelers complain. So clearly that's another subject that will have to be revisited, I think similar to what happened after 9/11, where people said, well, we just have to put up with this because it's the only way we're going to catch people. And those issues are now being revisited again.
So, again, the primary response of the administration so far is to say it's going to investigate why he didn't get on the watch list, how the material got on board, and is it possible to prevent that from happening again?
Yeah. Do they need to revise these systems?
Sure.
In order to make sure that this gap that has clearly been revealed by this particular case is closed.
Karen DeYoung, again, a senior diplomatic correspondent with The Washington Post. Many thanks to you.
You're very welcome.
In a moment, more on airline security on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're Manali back with To the Point. Once again, here's Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano.
We have deployed new technology in some airports. The question is, would it have detected this material in the way he had hidden it on his person? We're ascertaining that. We're ascertaining why it was that he was not flagged in a more specific way when he purchased his ticket.
Once again, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Bruce Hoffman, is a professor in security studies at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. He's author of Inside Terrorism, one of America's foremost experts on that subject. Bruce Hoffman, it's always good to have you on our program.
Well, thank you, Warren.
What happened?
Well, I think as Karen DeYoung described, there was a compound of multiple failures that at any point should have at least caught this somehow, and that it's lamentable 8 years into 9/11 we're sort of back to square one with Richard Reed bringing the same type of explosive on board an aircraft.
Is there, though, so much political and other kind of resistance to the X-ray machines, the swabbing techniques that it would take to detect that material, PETN, that it's politically been at least impossible to, and also too costly to institute those machines?
Well, you're right. I mean, we have to parse this a bit. To detect the explosive material, you're talking about something separate than, let's say, the body scanner, which is just looking for anything unusual on someone's person itself. That has generally been the technology that has flagged the greatest civil liberties concerns. And only a few months ago, last year, Congress had basically said had not approved their deployment as part of a security measure. To actually physically detect the explosive itself, it's more that it's just time-consuming, in that if you're going to subject everyone in a security line to having their luggage swapped, it would create bottlenecks. Now, there is the bomb-sniffing technology that would have picked it up, at least picked it up if it was on someone's person, you know, sealed inside of a plastic bag in someone's underwear. It's not even clear it would have necessarily gotten that. But there are many people who object to that, not for privacy reasons, but again, just because of the delay and because they don't like standing in a cylinder and having a puff of air shot at them. But I think what this incident raises is more questions than answers, and the questions are going to be, where do we draw the line between prudence and privacy?
Prudence and privacy. What about the issue of the watch list and the fact that, as we just heard from Karen, he might have gotten onto a watch list but didn't? He did in Britain. They have denied him the opportunity to have a new visa. Had he tried to get on or enter Britain, he would have been refused.
Precisely. I think that's another one of the big questions. Why is it that the British system worked and the American system in this case failed? But even more to the point, the American system, at least according to news reports, the State Department did flag his file and said that the next time he applies for a visa, he shouldn't be issued one, that he required further investigation. And I think that becomes a big question now. And what was the point of flagging his file for some future investigation? Why not have canceled or revoked his visa right now and conducted that investigation if he elicited at least that modicum of interest?
How much does this have to do with the number of people involved and the urging by the Congress that the watch lists be narrowed because too many people were getting investigated?
Well, I'm not sure necessarily that it's a matter of the, you know, congressional pressure to keep the list more modest and grand as much as it is our approach to security overall, which is, in essence, everybody showing at the airport is treated equally, and equal suspicion is focused on them. And this, the various advocates argue of enhanced screening and security, argue that what we should be doing is something more along the line of what the Israelis do, for example, and that's using a variety of behavioral indicators, a variety of background information to focus in on the specific individuals who seem more of a threat or more suspicious than others and let, for instance, the 80-year-old grandmother proceed on her way because she's not a threat.
Now, what was it about this gentleman that by that standard might have alerted people to at least look him over more carefully, if not just bar him from getting on the plane?
Paying for the flight and cash. I mean, this is something that's become almost a cliche back from 9/11, is that people who don't pay with a credit card, who you can't check, for instance, that they have some credit history or that they're a frequent flyer, that they have some background or some pedigree, someone who just shows up at an airport, pays for a ticket with cash, has no checked luggage and is going on a very long trip, that's not to say this person is a terrorist and bells and whistles and sirens should sound. But rather, what it should suggest is this is a person that deserves, or indeed requires, some additional scrutiny.
Have we been lax in this country? Has it been because of political concerns? Do you think that this incident will make any significant change?
Well, I think it'll be very unfortunate if it doesn't make any change, because it's, I think, revealed a vulnerability that's quite worrisome, especially 8 years into the war on terrorism. It goes beyond, though, politics. I mean, politics is part of them. The economy is another part. I mean, the airline's already suffering enormously. You make it far more inconvenient for people to travel by air, or are they really going to want to travel? I mean, you'll have, as we did in 2001 and 2002, more people taking longer trips, for instance, at least in the U.S., by car. So it's political, it's economic. I think what's ironic, though, is that this is one case where the technology is available. We don't have to wait for some huge scientific or technological or engineering breakthrough. We have bomb-sniffing detectors. We have body scan capabilities. I think it's probably more a question of, again, this line between prudence and privacy. And indeed, I think as Congress will look at this issue in the new year, can we adopt and harness this technology, but do so with processes and procedures in place that provide still for privacy, that don't result in a blanket violation, but that strike this balance between enabling people to fly in the confidence that they're safe and secure, but nonetheless that also their rights aren't being violated.
Bruce Hoffman, a professor at Georgetown University, author of Inside Terrorism, as always, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Philip Baum is editor of Aviation Security International. He's also managing director of Greenlight Limited. That's a London-based aviation security consultancy company. And Philip Baum, it's good to have you on our program as well.
Yeah, good day to you.
What about profiling?
Well, I've been a long-time passionate believer in passenger profiling. I know on your side of the pond, it's almost regarded as a swear word, but I believe it is the one proven method that has identified terrorist attacks in the past and will continue to do so in the future, almost regardless of the method or the modus operandi of the terrorist groups. I fear that what we always do is after an incident is we try and patch the hole that was shown to the world. But most of these holes were long known by the aviation security community. So after Richard Reid, we started to take people's shoes off, and now we're thinking about body scanners because that was what happened on Christmas Day. Profiling addresses the possibility of a chemical or biological weapons attack. It addresses the possibility of somebody having a bomb carried inside them.
You say that this is a proven method. Tell us how it's been proven, and has it been done without what's referred to as racial or cultural profiling?
Well, absolutely it's been done without reference to racial profiling. I mean, the best example is the Anne Marie Murphy story, which was the incident in 1986 when a young, pregnant, 29-year-old Catholic Irish girl tried to board an El Al flight to Tel Aviv. She certainly didn't meet our stereotypical image of a terrorist, but she was identified because she didn't meet the baseline behavior of passengers flying to Israel at Easter time. Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, was in fact denied boarding on the 21st of December 2001 because of his appearance and behavior. But perhaps more pertinently, every single day at airports around the globe, we have immigration officers and customs officers who are screening passengers as they get off planes in different ways, but primarily focusing on people's behavior, and they're finding people doing things wrong. And they're doing that after they've gotten off an aircraft. So really, you know, why don't we do it before people get onto an aircraft?
I agree with
everything that Bruce Hoffman just said, except for one thing. The technology we've got actually isn't ready yet. You know, we look at, for example, explosive trace detection systems. Yes, they exist, but they can only detect certain types of explosives. And if I know that, I guarantee the terrorist knows that. If we use body scanners, the ones they're talking about deploying are the ones that can see beneath the clothing. But drug traffickers every day swallow things or insert them into other body orifices and board aircraft. Terrorists could do the same thing. In fact, they have done so even this year.
Can't they, though, learn what it is that you're looking for when you do behavioral testing or look at people's appearances and simply act the right part?
Well, people often say that, and I'm not saying that profiling is foolproof. But the one thing that I can guarantee is the one thing they can really learn how to get around is the technology. Archway metal detectors only detect metal. That's the only substance they can detect. They cannot detect explosives or carbon or glass or wood or any other weapon made of any other substance other than metal. X-ray machines have never been proven as an effective way of identifying improvised explosive devices. The screening checkpoint we have at airports around the globe is pretty much the same as it was in the 1960s when we were trying to identify hijackers armed with dense metallic objects like guns and grenades and knives that wanted to go to Havana, Cuba. We are in a different era now, and we need an intelligent response to intelligent, educated terrorists. When we give training, we always tell our students, put yourselves in the shoes of a terrorist. Look at your environment. How would you penetrate, infiltrate something on board your aircraft or get through the security? Now let's start to develop a security system that addresses that.
Okay. Philip Baum, again, at Aviation Security International and Managing Director of Greenlight Limited. Scott Shane is a national security reporter for the New York Times. And Scott, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Who is Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab?
He is the son of a wealthy, elite Nigerian family. His dad is a former government official and perhaps the country's most prominent banker before he stepped down as chairman of a large bank last year. And he was raised in privilege in Nigeria, went to a very well-thought-of high school in Togo, neighboring Togo, then went on to London to an elite university where he studied engineering. And by most accounts, he was a very diligent student. His teachers thought well of him. But from an early age, he was considered to be quite religious. And at some point, apparently in his time in London, between 2005 and 2008, he became attracted to extreme religious ideas, and eventually he broke ties with his family, traveled to Yemen, and got involved in this plot.
What does this tell us about Yemen?
Well, Yemen has gradually emerged as a very important center for al-Qaeda. It's sort of the affiliate called al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula in Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And certainly it's become quite a hub for terrorism. They're looking at whether this guy had any contact with Anwar al-Awlaki, who is the same U.S.-born Yemeni radical cleric who had corresponded with Nidal Hassan, the army psychiatrist, who's accused of shooting up Fort Hood in November. So there may be another connection to that same guy in al-Qaeda.
Earlier we heard Bruce Hoffman say that we need to make a trade-off and focus on the trade-off between what he called prudence and privacy. What about the history of dealing with this issue since September 11th? And what kinds of changes did you expect when Congress returns?
Well, as has been noted, you know, there's a tendency to focus on the exact methodology used by the last attacker, in the case of Richard Reed, or perhaps in the case of this guy. You know, a lot of people will tell you that it's impossible to have a foolproof system when there are so many vulnerabilities and so many attack points. You know, we're now focused on aviation because that happens to have been the focus of this fellow. But you know, there was a military recruiting center shot up, Fort Hood was shot up. There are certainly train stations and bus stations and malls and all kinds of places where attacks could occur. So it's hard to say what Congress is going to do, other than to take a hard look, as the Obama administration has already said it's going to do, at both watch listing of potential terrorists and screening at airports.
Scott Shane, again, national security reporter for the New York Times. Philip Baum, just very quickly, we only have about 15 or 20 seconds left, but should this gentleman, this particular person, have been identified by the kind of profiling you're talking about? Would that have done the job?
Absolutely. Ticket paid in cash in Ghana. Journey started in Nigeria, ended in the United States, traveling for 2 weeks with no luggage. He should have been identified. Something went wrong.
Philip Baum, Scott Shane, and our earlier guest, Bruce Hoffman, thank you all very much for being with us today. President Obama is scheduled to make a statement later today. We'll have more on airline security on tomorrow's program. In a moment, the growing problem of hunger in a struggling economy. On To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The Great Recession has increased the number of Americans who depend on food stamps and food banks to get enough to eat. What kind of food do they get? Do food stamps carry a stigma? Do they create dependency at the same time? Do private charities allow government to avoid dealing directly with the causes of poverty? Our first guest is Professor Mark Rank from Washington University in St. Louis. He's co-author of a recent study on children and food stamps. Professor Rank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
What did you find out in your study?
Well, the bottom line here is we found that between the ages of 1 and 20, half of all American kids at some point will be in a household that receives food stamps. So it's a very wide reach that the program has.
Has the program been very much broadened since it was first established? Is that part of the reason that so many people are eligible for it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It started, as a pilot program in the early 1960s, and has since expanded. And it's one of the very few social safety net programs that we have that a lot of different folks can qualify for. So whether you're young or old, whether you're a married couple or a single person, all of these different types of households can qualify for the program. So it's probably the widest reaching safety net program that we have here in the United States.
How much has it usage of it increased because of the recession?
Oh, it's. I was just looking at these numbers. It's gone from around in February of 2007. About 26 million people were receiving the program. To the latest data, which is September of 2009, 37 million.
Wow.
So there's been an 11 million number increase, and certainly in the next few months, that's only going to go higher.
So what's the implication of this as far as children are concerned? What do you think is the impact on them?
Well, you know, one of the arguments we make in this paper is that food stamps is really an indicator of both poverty and food insecurity, and both of those things have detrimental effects on kids. So there's been a lot of medical research to show that even slight amounts of undernutrition in terms of children can have effects in terms of cognitive ability, in terms of physical health. And so these are issues that, you know, we as a society really need to pay attention to. If our kids aren't getting enough to eat, that has some really important implications.
Mark Rank, again, at Washington University in St. Louis. We'll come back to you. But first, let me introduce Oren Hesterman, who's president and CEO of the Fair Food Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's a nonprofit that promotes access to fresh, local, sustainably grown food. And Oren Hesterman, thank you for being on our program.
You're very welcome. Pleased to be with you.
When people get food stamps, however they may qualify for them, what kind of food do they get?
Well, it really depends a lot on where those people live. We know, for example, that in Detroit, Michigan, most of the residents there have no access any longer to a large full-service grocery store. So most of their food access, if they can't drive to the suburbs, is going to be from small corner grocers, convenience stores, or even gas stations.
So what does that mean in terms of what they eat and what it means nutritionally?
It means that many of the residents of low-income communities like in Detroit who are relying on food stamps for part or all of their nutrition are really getting the bad end of the stick on this. They are really not able to access food that can keep their families and kids healthy,
so,
even with this government assistance.
So can we trace the kind of food they eat to the kinds of diseases that they suffer from in later life? We just heard that not having enough, having undernutrition, can have cognitive problems and also physical health problems.
I believe there's very strong correlation between the poor diets experienced by folks living in these communities and the chronic diet-related illnesses that are at much higher incidence also in those communities. So absolutely, my feeling is if we want to really seriously address health and health care in this country, we ought to be addressing food access and nutrition primarily.
Oren Hesterman again, CEO of the Fair Food Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Back to Mark Rank at Washington University in St. Louis. A little more on the number of people that we were talking about and where they are. Oren Hesterman just said people in the inner cities, particularly in the city of Detroit, don't have access to good food. Is that true of a large number of those who are on food stamps, or are there plenty of people now in the suburbs that are also on the food stamp program?
Well, you know, they're both true. I've been doing a lot of work on what's the likelihood that an American might experience poverty at some point in their lifetime. And actually, 60% of Americans at some point between the ages of 20 and 75 will encounter a year below the poverty line. And that includes people in suburbs, people in inner city areas. So the reach of poverty is very widespread. Now, it's certainly true that
I want you to stop
yeah.
a moment.
Mm-hmm.
60% of the people between the ages of 20 and 75 are going to spend 1 year below the poverty level in the United States of America?
That's right.
Richest country in the world.
Yes. That's exactly right. And people oftentimes say, how can this be? How can these numbers be so high? Here's the reason. You're talking about a long period of time in people's lives, 40 or 50 years. Things happen to people that they didn't expect. For example, losing a job in the current recession, somebody gets sick, families split up. All these things have the potential to throw families into poverty. And when they do, in the United States, we don't have a lot to protect families in terms of a safety net. One of the few programs we do have is the food stamp program. So it's actually a lot of people, particularly today, are using the program that never thought that they ever would have to use the program. And those are folks in both suburban areas, in rural areas, in which you also have the issue of perhaps not having access to a full-service grocery store, and also an inner-city area. So it's a widespread problem.
So that means that the middle class, as we think of it, maybe isn't as large as we would like to believe.
Or that there's a lot of economic vulnerability in America. And that's one of the things that we've seen over the last 30 years. People are more and more at economic risk. So, for example, your job is less stable today. Benefits are harder to get. All of these things have been occurring over the last 30 or 40 years to put more and more Americans at economic risk when particular events happen, such as losing your job.
What about the stigma associated with food stamps? Is that still a problem?
Well, that's a really interesting point, because originally one of the ideas of having the stamps was actually to physically stigmatize people so that they would be very reluctant to use the program. But in the last few years, what we've seen is the Department of Agriculture has really made an attempt to try to make the program less stigmatizing. So there's been more outreach. There's been a change of the program from food stamps to the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So there have been attempts to say, we need to, folks that are in need, we really want to encourage them to try to get this nutritional assistance.
Mark Rank again at Washington University in St. Louis. I'll be back with you, back with Orrin Hesterman as well. First, here's Ron Haskins. He's co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. He's a former White House and congressional advisor on welfare issues, instrumental in the 1996 overhaul of national welfare policy during the Clinton years. Ron Haskins, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How do you think the food stamp program is working?
Excellent. I don't think there's been nearly enough credit in this conversation in the food stamp program. It's expanded very dramatically, almost by 40% since the recession started in December of 2007. It serves the highest number of people, the highest percentage of people, the highest percentage of children, and also what is technically called the penetration rate, that is, of all the eligibles who actually get the benefit, that is also the highest it's ever been. So food stamps has done exactly what it should do during a recession, which is expand rapidly to cover more and more people who are, in many cases, in fact, in most cases, probably unemployed.
What about this issue we heard about with regard to the kind of food that's available, particularly in inner cities, to people who have to depend on food stamps? Is there some way to deal with that?
I don't think the problem is as widespread as implied. People get a very much like a credit card to buy food stamps. And they can use it at most stores, have machines that will accept the credit cards. It is a problem in some inner cities that there aren't enough grocery stores available, but that certainly cannot be the fault of the food stamp program itself. There are grocery stores all across the United States. Most communities have a lot of grocery stores, and people can get access to grocery stores. I would say a very small minority of people do not have access to a grocery store that has reasonably priced food. So it is a problem some places, as Orrin Hesterman said, but those are relatively few, and that cannot be a problem attributed to the food stamp program itself.
Orrin Hesterman, if it can't be attributed to the food stamp program, what can be done about it?
Well, what I would agree with Ron that I would not attribute this issue of inability to access healthy food as a, quote, problem of the food stamp program. It's not, and I agree with him. I think it's an excellent way for the federal government to help those who need assistance with being able to purchase food be able to do so. I view this problem of lack of access to healthy food as a problem of a broken food system, and this is just one symptom. But one thing I do want to point out, that of the 160, this is data from 2008, of the 166,000 outlets or vendors that are eligible across the United States to receive food stamps, or as Ron pointed out, this EBT, Electronic Benefits Transfer Card, out of 166,000, only 34,000 of them are designated as either grocery stores or supermarkets by the USDA. So I do believe the problem or the issue, the symptom of lack of access to healthy food for those using EBT cards or the SNAP program is more widespread than I would believe by listening to Ron.
So what's the implication of that?
Well, I think the implication is that we need to, while we have a program that I believe has done a good job, there is room for improvement without a doubt. There is room for improvement in terms of making sure that when we use our federal benefits, when we target our federal benefits to helping increase people's access to good nutrition, we are actually helping them access better food and not just giving them more money to buy food that may not be that healthy for them in outlets that are not providing a full range of foods. In Detroit, something we are starting to do, and it's happening around in different places around the country, and we hope to spread this across the state of Michigan next year, is a demonstration project whereby anybody who brings their electronic benefits card or their SNAP benefits to a farmer's market is able to buy healthy, fresh, locally and sustainably grown food. They're able to get double the amount that they would spend on their SNAP card. So if they use $10 of their federal benefit to buy healthy, fresh produce, they actually get $20 worth of buying power. In effect, incentivizing folks to come and spend their federal dollars on healthier food while also supporting a local food economy.
Orrin Hesterman at the Fair Food Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Back to Ron Haskins, and now with Brookings, formerly with the Clinton White House. What do you say to that?
I say that's right. I think that it's a perfect example of the way government social policy is supposed to work. There are federal policy that provides a very strong program, a lot of money, a lot of outreach, and a lot of coverage. And then it's adapted at the local level for problems that are experienced at the state or local level, exactly as Orrin is doing. That's the way social policy should work, and it's the right thing. If it could be shown that too few grocery stores allow use of the EBT card, in effect, credit card, then there should be more outreach on the federal level and by state governments to convince more grocery stores to make sure that they have available the equipment necessary to accept food stamp cards. It's my understanding that most grocery stores, especially national chains, do allow the use of EBT cards. Orrin may have some more recent information on that than I do, but there are many local grocery stores that may not accept it, so maybe there needs to be more outreach.
All right, so we're talking about a huge increase in the food stamp program, very successful in reaching the people that it is designed to reach, reaching those who are eligible so they know about it and presumably are able to collect their benefits in a way that isn't always the case with programs in of the United States. Let me introduce Mark Winnie. He is author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. He was executive director for 25 years of the Hartford Food System. That's a nonprofit in Hartford, Connecticut that works on food and hunger issues. And Mark Winnie, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I know one of the things you're concerned about, particularly with the increase in the food stamp program, is the issue of dependency. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm concerned that we have almost take pride in the growth in the food stamp program, and I would add to that the growth in food banks around the country over the last 30 years. Food stamp participation has grown from 17 million in 1999 to 37 million today, and that certainly a big boost in that rate has been due to the recent recession. I don't think that we should take such pride in it. I think the food stamp program and food banks do a very adequate job of keeping people out of hunger in the United States, but they really just manage the cause of hunger, which is poverty. They're not doing anything other than alleviating the worst symptoms of poverty. And in that sense, I feel like as a nation we have been somewhat distracted from a much larger goal, which ought to be in trying to end poverty in the United States, something that we seem to spurn And I would also agree that I think we need to reinvest in our communities and try to rebuild the wealth of our communities, I think, in the way that Orrin is suggesting, perhaps through a reinvestment in supermarkets in those communities that are underserved. There's many ways that we've avoided the bigger question, which is poverty.
That being the case, though, you're certainly not suggesting that we not alleviate the symptom, are you, as we try to deal with the root causes?
Oh, of course not. I mean, I believe that we need to be feeding Americans when they're hungry. There's just no doubt about that. But, you know, we have 15 federal food assistance programs operating currently. They're spending somewhere in the order of $70 to $80 billion a year. We don't seem to want to take a look at that and decide if that is really the most effective strategy to address the long-term problem. And I'd also suggest that the problem has a lot to do with our low-wage economy, that we have not held American businesses accountable for the low wages that they're paying people, wages which in many, many cases are so low that they're eligible for the food stamp program, which means, in effect, that the American taxpayer is subsidizing many of those low-wage businesses.
Subsidizing, you mean by providing food, in this case, to people who simply can't afford to get it on their own?
That's right. I mean, Henry Ford, as the mythology goes anyway, paid his workers enough so that they could afford to actually buy the cars they were making. Why can't American businesses pay their employees enough so that they can afford to feed themselves?
Mark Winnie, again, author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. What about, in the meantime, the question of dependency? And does the food stamp program, along with the food banks that are available, do you think lead people to not do more for themselves?
I don't think it's food stamps or the food itself that might be handed out at a food bank or a food pantry that creates dependency. I'm more concerned about the people who advocate very strongly for food stamps and also those who are strong advocates and operators and managers and proponents of food banking, that they're not taking a look at the causes of the hunger that they're alleviating through their programs, and that they themselves are entering into a relationship of codependency, sometimes with the food industry itself, sometimes with their own clients, sometimes with their donors and communities. Food banks have gone through, we have 205 major food bank warehouses in this country, 63,000 food pantries. There have been numerous, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of capital campaigns undertaken by food banks just to expand them. The one food bank that I started in Hartford, Connecticut in the early 1980s has gone through five expansions since that time. I think that that's where the codependency tends to exist.
Mark Winnie again, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Ron Haskins, back to you, Brookings Institution.
Yeah, I'd like to make a brief point here, which is that everybody has to agree on because the numbers are so stark. You cannot get out of poverty in the United States unless you work, if you're a working-age family. The combined value of cash, welfare, and food stamps for a family of three is around $10,000. A poverty level for a family of three is just a little under $20,000. So you have to work to get out of poverty. Therefore, if advocates are really concerned about poverty, then they should be concerned about work and helping as many able-bodied families as possible work. Now, of course, a program like that doesn't work well during a recession. But when we try, we're only in a recession 10 to 15% of the time. So when we tried this program in the 96 welfare reforms, hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of families left welfare. 70 to 75% of them actually worked, and granted they were in low-wage jobs. But then we created a system to support their low wages. So they got cash through the Earned Income Tax Credit as much as $5,000. They got food stamps, which can be worth $3,000 or $4,000, and for a family with no income, it can be worth as much as $6,000, and help with child care and so forth. So the goal of advocates of the poor in order to reduce poverty and to reduce dependency should be to help people work. And yet the food stamp program has very weak work requirements. There's no reason that we should have weak work requirements in the food stamp program. Under normal circumstances, there are plenty of low-wage jobs in the United States. If people get a low-wage job, they can get it supplemented by food stamps. The kids are covered by Medicaid, and under the new health insurance plans, probably adults will be covered as well. They can get help with child care, and they get very big help through the tax code, the earned income tax credit and child tax credit. So work is the key to reducing poverty and reducing dependency.
I want to get back and ask you about the issue raised by Mark Winnie of whether or not we ought to put pressure on employers to raise wages. Let me do that after we take a very brief break. We'll be right back with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're not only back with To the Point to talking about the vast expansion of the food stamp program. Mark Winnie says we're simply alleviating the symptom of the greater problem, which is poverty. Ron Haskins agrees that people ought to go to work for their food stamps. But, Ron Haskins, if you support them and subsidize them in their low-wage jobs, aren't you really just perpetuating the problem?
No, I don't think so. The question is, what do you do about people who don't have enough education to qualify for jobs that pay, say, $30,000, $40,000 in the American economy? This is going to be an increasing problem in the future because our high school dropout rate is so great. This is not a problem that's going to go away. So we have to create a system where people that can only work for a minimum wage or a little bit above can survive and can have children. And so we've done that with the creation of the earned income tax credit, child tax credit, food stamps, and so forth. And we've made that system work better. There's still flaws in it. For example, we should be spending more money on daycare. But it's a much better approach than imposing the entire burden on employers and forcing them to pay higher wages. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of employers in the United States barely make a profit now. And if you increase wages, at some point it's bound to have an impact on employment. It's much better to pay it out of general revenues, tax everybody in the country, and pay directly low-income workers, especially those with children, through a mechanism like the earned income tax credit, which is much better than raising the minimum wage.
Mark Winnie, back to you. What do you say to that, and how would you deal directly with the problem of poverty without driving businesses out of or companies out of business?
I wish I had a dollar for every business that's told me that it's going to leave the state, leave the city, or leave the country if it had to pay higher wages. I simply can't accept that. I think that why should the taxpayer be constantly subsidizing low-wage industries? I mean, it was FDR said near the end of his administration that no company that does not pay its employees a decent wage, by which he meant a living wage, has any business doing business in this country. And I think we need to take that position. If not, we need to find a partnership, and I do emphasize that partnership idea between the public sector and the private sector, that does what I think Ron is proposing, that we begin to increase the capacity of individuals to be able to earn more money through education, through health care, job training, and through reinvesting in American businesses so that they can afford to pay higher wages. We can't become a Walmart economy or have that be our largest growth industry for the next 10 or 20 years. That will just take the rest of us down over time.
Let's just get a couple of comments from our other guests before we run out of time here. Orrin Hesterman, back to you with the Fair Food Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Just very interested in your take on the conversation between Ron Haskins and Mark Winnie.
Yeah, I think we have to be careful not to look at this as an either-or proposition, that we either take care of the symptoms of an economy where so many people are going hungry, or we somehow think about how to take care of the long-term issues. I think we can do both at the same time. And getting back to the core of the conversation here, the food stamp or SNAP program, it is a perfect opportunity that we are absolutely missing. One example, in Detroit, there's $450 million of federal money coming in for SNAP benefits annually to families in Detroit. 60% of that money is getting redeemed now at liquor stores and party stores where people are not getting adequate nutrition for their kids. We could use a good part of that $450 million to both have people get better food and support a more local food economy, which could create jobs and which could help the economy in Detroit and Southeast Michigan, which really needs it right now. So I believe we can do a both and if we think about it and restructure the system that's in place right now. Both take care of the symptoms of hunger and at the same time build jobs and a local food economy for the future.
Professor Mark Rank at Washington University, very quickly, if you will. We've got about 30 seconds left.
Yes, I mean, I think we all agree that jobs that pay a decent wage, a living wage, are critical in addressing poverty. So that's clearly one thing that's important. The other thing that's important that the United States doesn't do is have universal programs for things like health care, child care, housing assistance. And so we need to have those kind of programs in place also to help families.
Well, thank you all very much. Mark Rank again at Washington University in St. Louis. One Nation Underprivileged is his book. Oren Hesterman, CEO of the Fair Food Network in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ron Haskins at the Brookings Institution, formerly with the Clinton administration. Mark Winnie, author of Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Many thanks to all of you for being with us today. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Carolyn Radziner and Gary Scott. Our Technical Director Wesley Roberts. Email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.